first, I'd like to welcome to this Atlantic Interview Disc series one of, I guess you'd call it Rock's Intelligentsia, writer, singer, editor, Pete Townsend. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you today, Pete.
Thank you.
Now, the last music we heard from Pete Townsend was the release of, by popular demand, of Pete Townsend's Deep End Live, the Brixton, England concerts. Mm-hmm. Now we have the Iron Man. Now, could you fill us in about these last few years, how you came upon the Ted Hughes book, The Iron Man?
The book was given to me by a guy who was an editor working for me in 1976. I started a book publishing company then to do rock books and children's books. And he gave me the book as an example of what we should aspire to. You know, he said, this is a really great children's story. It's not just, you know, about you know, inanimate teddy bear shaped objects having fun, but it really has some depth as well, and it's a great classic. And I read it and I loved it and I agreed with him, and it just kind of then went to the back of my mind. And a bit later, Roger Daltrey, about 3 years ago, and I had some success with a song called After the Fire on his album, and we agreed to try to do some more together. I looked around for a subject for him, and the title Iron Man leapt out. I thought, you know, what does Roger represent in rock and roll? He represents this kind of Iron Man, and I like the title. And I went back and read the book, and I realized that there was more to it than that, and the real essence of the story came through to me, and I decided to do it as a project for me. The story is very similar in a way to Tommy, to Quadrophenia,
sure,
to a lot of early Who singles. It's about, you know, the fear and deprivation and isolation of children, you know, particularly of a little boy in this particular context, but, you know, and although this sounds like kind of shrink couch stuff, I think it's also what I've always believed lies at the essence of rock and roll. So I just thought, this is, I should do something with this.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel this is a children's story or a story for children of all ages?
I don't think it's either. I think it's a fairy tale, which is a very different thing. Mm-hmm. I think fairy, you know, Tommy was a fairy tale.
Right.
You know, I think the Who are a fairy tale.
Could you
and
define
the Iron Man is a fairy tale.
Could you define fairy tale then?
A fairy tale is a story which is actually about blood and death and killing and birth and ghosts, reality, dreams, sleep, okay, religion.
Now, before we go through the songs on the record, which I like to do, do you want to set up the story in general, or should we just dive right into the song?
No, I mean, I can set up the story. An Iron Man comes out of the sea and walks up onto a beach, an enormous, you know, like as high as a building, with eyes like laser beams, and nearby there's a boy called Hogarth who's fishing early in the morning, and he's obviously been night fishing, and he's dozing a little bit, and a star shoots across the sky, and in the distance there's strange things happening, you know, the sounds of distant wars and distant historical atomic explosions and stuff. But basically, you've got a peaceful English country scene, and the boy wakes up suddenly, aware of this presence, and he looks behind him, and there's the Iron Man standing on the hill. As the boy realizes there's something strange happening, the Iron Man falls back and smashes into 1,000 pieces on the beach, and a seagull comes and picks up an eye and takes it to a nest, and then you suddenly realize that the hand is moving and the legs are moving, and slowly but surely the Iron Man actually puts himself back together again and walks back into the sea. Hogarth is terribly afraid temporarily, but is reassured by the normality of the English countryside scene, and a little later sees the Iron Man in some fields eating barbed wire, eating tractors, eating machinery, and generally consuming anything that is metal, and runs away to tell his father, and his father and he pursue the Iron Man in their car. At one point they actually hit it and knock it down, and his father mobilizes the farming community, and they set about trying to trap the Iron Man, and they dig a pit for it, a trap. But the Iron Man is a bit too clever to fall into the trap. But Hogarth manages to attract him one day into the trap by clinking a nail against the edge of his penknife, and it's the sound of the metal, particularly the stainless steel, which the Iron Man sort of regards as a juicy treat. And he falls into the trap. Hogarth, and they pour earth on top of him, and Hogarth actually feels very sad. Suddenly, he feels he's, in a way, he's attracted the Iron Man and then betrayed him. And as the Iron Man has fallen into the hole, their eyes have met, and there's some kind of contract gone down there, and he feels very badly about that. A little while later, some picnickers gather, and the Iron Man breaks up through the ground and is released again. And again, Hogarth comes to the rescue by consoling the Iron Man by leading him to a scrapyard. So then the Iron Man, instead of just aimlessly running around consuming metal, actually starts to deal with some of our waste problems.
And
time passes in the story, and the star that we see at the beginning actually starts to get large, and it starts to approach the Earth. And it lands on Australia, practically covering Australia. And it turns out to be this enormous, unbelievably awful dragon, which demands living creatures to eat, living things. It has to have living things to eat, and gives an ultimatum that if it doesn't get an endless supply of living things to eat, then it's going to destroy the planet. And we unify and solidify and throw our combined military might at this creature, and with no effect at all. And again, Hogarth comes to the rescue. He goes and asks the Iron Man if he can help out, and the Iron Man says, yeah, I'll be your champion. And the Iron Man challenges the space dragon to an ordeal by fire, in which the Iron Man is roasted on a grid, on a funeral pyre, and the space dragon has to be tested in a fire of equal size, a proportion with his size in the sun. And the Iron Man wins. The space dragon gives up in the story quite easily, and the Iron Man becomes an international hero. And it turns out that the space dragon is quite a benign creature, really, which has actually become wayward because of being attracted by the horrible things that have been happening on Earth, and whose original job was to create celestial music. And so they pack the space dragon back off into space to continue with the celestial music, and everybody lives happily ever after. And the variations that I make to the story are that, as far as I'm concerned, the Iron Man is obviously a father figure, the space dragon is a mother figure. I'm sorry if you ladies don't appreciate the simile there, but anyway, the space dragon is not just about consuming living things, but also about consuming innocence, in a sense. So when the space dragon lands, she contains everything that is innocent and beautiful that she's managed to gather in her travels around the universe. Lots of children, and one in particular, one very, very beautiful girl who Hogarth becomes infatuated with, just to give the story some kind of romance.
You added a love story in there. Well, okay, now let's get into the music, which will obviously reflect some of what you've just said. The album opens up with there's this bell tolling, and then there's Hogarth's scream, and there's a classic Townsend guitar riff right at the beginning, which I think wakes folks up. And the song is I Won't Run Anymore.
What actually happens at the beginning is that I'm trying to make the point that what Hogarth is dealing with is adulthood. He's, in the story, he's 10 or 11 years old. He's actually contemplating the coming years of becoming a man, of growing up. And he is afraid of the responsibilities that will bring, but also afraid of some of the things that he's got to face. And when he first sees the star in the sky, when he first sees the shining lights of the Iron Man on the top of the hill, the first thing that comes into his mind is that, you know, I can't run from this anymore. I can't run away. the story is about nightmares, in a sense. It's about fear, and what happens in children, and what happens in the story is that you see how we finally get to grips with encountering that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned Deborah Conway. She was established before, you know, and you...
That's right. She sings in a band called Do Re Mi. And at first, I asked her to play the role of Hogarth. So she was actually going to be singing the role of a 10-year-old boy. And then I went to see her play, and she was wearing a slinky red dress, and she had her hair flying around, and she's just about one of the sexiest presents I've ever seen on the stage, and I thought, this is not going to work, you know. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, listen, you know, would you mind playing something a little bit more foxy? And she said that she wouldn't. And what did I suggest? And I said, well, how about a fox? You know?
Brilliant.
And I've now sort of even bowed to the sexist implications of that and allowed her to at least be a vixen. What happens at this part of the story, you see, is that you're not sure whether it's a dream or reality, but it is, of course, reality. What is happening is that the vixen in this story is Hogarth's conscience. It's what's driving him to wake up and move forward. In a way, the idea that it's an animal, but a good animal, is trying to tend to kind of the fairy tale idea that, you know, what we're all made up of, male and female, and also part of our responses to the things that we don't understand about life are deep primitive selves. You know, we know that, you know, that there are no such things as ghosts, and yet, you know, when we're children and sometimes when we're adults, there are moments when we're afraid of that. That's our primitive self responding, our animal self. We know that if we get, you know, in the wrong lane on the freeway and somebody honks once too many times, that we become quite capable of getting out of the car and hitting somebody very hard, that we have no real grudge against at all.
Right.
And feeling terribly guilty about that response. You know, these are all animal responses. So I felt that the function of the animal chorus in this, and particularly the vixen, was to deal with all of those things which Hogarth was going to have to deal with in the course of this story. And the most important being the vixen, which is played by Deborah Conway. And she joins me as Hogarth. I play Hogarth in the thing. She joins me on that song.
Yeah. This song descends with violins into the next one, which, I mean, throughout this record, there's so much humor in there that is delightful to listen to. Like, Over the Top is kind of a funny song. Over the Top We Go, yeah, 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 yeah. Which, if I'm not mistaken, is the Iron Man falling and breaking apart, isn't that?
It's also part, yeah, that's true. It's also part of his programming. It's part of his marine heritage.
Over the Top We Go.
Yeah.
I see.
Born to Kill, which would also make a good song. It just wouldn't be a sentiment that I would.
Born to Kill.
The humour has been actually very difficult to suppress. I mean, the whole idea of the story is very humorous. But when I finally worked with John Lee Hooker on this, the amazing thing was that a lot of the stuff he was so far out of his field, his blues field, that he didn't necessarily, he wasn't confident that he could interpret it. But, you know, he's got a wonderful sense of humour, and it really conveyed itself through the work, and it, you know, certainly was a great fun working with him. And, you know, there's just one little bit at the end where he goes, hee, 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 you know, there's that kind of, you know, diabolical laugh from the passing.
Dig, the opening of it reminds me of a Sam Cooke tune. Did you ever think of that?
No.
where it's Dig, whoo, and it's like the chain gang, that's the sound.
Oh, yeah, 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 no, no, of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is a... Yeah, that's precisely the effect that we wanted.
Yeah. Now, the song actually sounds suspiciously like a group that's celebrating its 25th
that's
anniversary,
right,
this year.
Yeah, they're my guests on this record. I really wanted Roger on the record, and then Dig had a synthesizer bass on it. And once Roger was on there, something seemed to be missing, and I figured it was, you know, really live bass, and I asked John if he minded doing it, and he agreed to do it.
Did you actually wind up going into the studio together at all, or was it separate, you know?
No, we were in the studio together. We worked together on it.
I mean, after 28 years, and then after, I guess, that hiatus sort of deal, and then coming back all together at once. What was that feeling like? Was it like the old magic is here? Or?
Well, it wasn't quite the old magic, but there was certainly a chemistry there.
Now, in the song Dig, this town has automatically decided that the Iron Man is a menace, as opposed to, like, maybe having an open mind or something about it.
That's right. Well, the response is that the Iron Man is a dangerous because he is destroying machinery. You know, there's an element, it's only a sort of a small point, really, but there are always two factions in any war. You know, if you're behind the lines on either side, you believe that you are in the right. And that's really the point, is that you suspend judgment when you go to war. You suspend judgment when you destroy something. You know, when you tread on a spider that you find in your bathroom, you temporarily put out of your mind whether there are any consequences to you, or to the spider, or to the world. It's not like you're saying, this is just unimportant, it's just a little creature. You're just saying, I don't know the answer to this, I can't deal with it. You know, if when I die, somebody pins me up against the wall and says, do you know that in your life you have killed 464 perfectly innocent spiders, and that means that you've got to spend 999 billion years burning in hell? You could kind of go, well, that's the luck of the draw. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and taken a bit further to the way that we respond when, you know, our country tells us that we've got to go to Vietnam and well, whatever it happens to be. We have to, you know, we have to suspend our judgment. And what's happening in Dig is in the story and in this song is that, you know, way back in the First World War, what men did to fight, one great evolution in the fighting machine was that men got off horses and dug holes in the ground, you know, digging in.
Trenches. And
digging in to make lines, and they became permanent. You know, some of them have scarred the European landscape to the extent that they're still visible. And the way that we bury our waste, and the way that we, in the English war, we used to go, in London in particular, we used to go and hide from air raids by going and sleeping in the subway. And I just felt all of those things were about the way that we bury the most important thing of all, which is our judgment, you know.
Yeah.
We can't afford to deal with it. So the Iron Man is obviously a threat in that particular circumstance. They don't understand where he comes from, what he represents. They're afraid, they're fearful. So they decide to, you know, suspend judgment, fight him, bury him, get rid of him. Put him out of their life.
Yeah. Now, the song that really cracks me up the most is the one we're getting to now, I Eat Heavy Metal. Was it fun for you to be coming up with the lyrics for this one?
Yeah. In the 2 weeks that I spent on the actual lyrics, I surrounded myself with books about robotics and space machinery and dragons and myths and legends and, you know, the Beowulf stuff and, you know, all kinds of stuff that I felt was relevant to what I was doing. I just immersed myself. And when it came to heavy metal, I just really wanted to, you know, to have fun really with the words, you know, just to. And actually, what's happening there is I'm showing off a bit, you know. It's like when I sit down at a typewriter, you know, I'm sometimes just amazed at how fluid the whole thing is, you know, because I'm my memory is not very good, and so when I'm talking, I find it difficult to remember names and faces and references, and I can't do that thing that you'll find people are so good at. It's actually what makes politicians really, is having that good surface memory to be able to remember dates and names and places. Or in my case, kind of, you know, musical or literary references. I just can't remember where it all comes from. But this, you know, one thing I do know is what music is made of, you know, where Live at Leeds came from.
Yeah.
And where heavy metal began.
Well, the lyrics, though, I eat heavy metal, gargle premium gas, I drink heavy water, nitro demitasse. I mean, that is great. That, and John Lee delivers that with that, the whole right attitude there. It's very, very...
Yeah, it's funny. Very strange. When we were doing it in the studio, on the demo, the emphasis, I eat heavy metal, like that. That was my... And he said to me, hey, Pete, should be, I eat heavy metal. So I said, well, that's fine, John, do it that way. Isn't it?
Right. Yeah. I eat heavy metal, you know.
Fast food is Well, this is, I guess, where the Hogarth and the rest of the planet get the proverbial cold surprise.
Yeah, that's right.
This thing lands on Australia and covers
right.
all of Australia.
That's right, yeah. It was fun writing the words for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that man is actually the junk food we're talking about. Or
that's
the fast
right, man actually is the junk food, yeah. He is the fast food.
This strikes me as fascinating about how man's folly has turned what was ostensibly a force for good into something evil. You know, the fact that this dragon from space and stuff just saw the way the planet was fighting amongst itself and said, oh, this looks like fun, let's join in.
Yeah.
You know, and in reality, the beast was supposed to actually provide harmony in the universe.
Yeah, it's a funny idea in a way. So it's an awkward idea. It's not one I feel entirely comfortable with that's come from the book. You see, there are lots of different people out there with lots of different faiths, and there are lots of people that have no faith at all. I don't want to implant any of my dogma into their lives. But, you know, I believe that God is the sum of man, you know, and in a way that God is, you know, when people talk in a religious sense about God being unlimited, they're in scale terms, they're right, of course, you know, the scale of creation is unlimited, but in terms of man, God is extremely limited. Man is how God is realized, how God is invented, if you like. You know, we're the ones who put a price tag on him and the conditions, we've done that. And yet we seem to have the greatest difficulty in living up to that target. And in a way, we are dragging down the God that we've created to our level all the time. We're creating this super being, this wonderful, all-seeing, all-pervading being, and then we keep dragging him down to our size. We keep saying, you know,
puts conditions.
This is what we're aiming at, but there's no way that we're ever going to achieve it. Or this is what we're aiming at, and in the name of this, we behave the way that we behave. We conduct wars. We exploit one another. I think everybody understands that. You know, everybody lives that. You know, and some people are actually having to live the rough end of it. You know, I mean, people talk a lot about the kids who are the victims of the crack campaign on the streets of a city like this, for example. But how do they think it feels to be a dealer? Mm. You know, those people are not living a very good life. They know that too. They know that. They know they're not living a very good life. I don't think they're pretending for a minute that
what they're doing
that's a good thing.
Right.
And in a way, the story is about the fact that that lust for experience, that lust for sustenance and for pleasure, and is so temporal, it's so limited. Somebody will, you know, if you demand it, somebody will deliver it. And it makes everything you know, it reduces the size of the world that we live in. It reduces the size of our imagination. So the dragon from space, you know, this creator of celestial music, is presumably one of, you know, one of God's muses, is dragged down and turned into the, you know, a hamburger freak. A great image.
Yeah. I guess the epilogue is where it all comes together and we have our happy ending, right?
The epilogue is just that. It's a footnote to the ordeal. You hear the dragon. I tried to musically create the fact that the dragon is subordinated, and the horrible screaming that she produces turns back to beautiful music, and she flies off back into the sky. And then the cast gathers for a song called New Life, which is really about, you know, the fact that now is an opportunity to go ahead, do something new, you know, create a better place. This is a song that I really did write very much with musical theatre in mind, you know, kind of a show closing song.